Our first case on calendar this morning is 73285, Carson Valley v. Hellwinkle Family Limited Partnership. If appellant's counsel is ready to proceed. Ms. Bowen. If you wish to reserve time, please so state.
I do. I would like to reserve 5 minutes if I might, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. Honorable Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court, Mark Gunderson appearing on behalf of the appellants. This case presents two significant issues that affected the substantial rights of the whole appellants during this trial. The first error was when the court admitted expert hearsay testimony contained in repair bids and entering that, allowing that evidence to be entered over objection was error.
Mr. Gunderson, I'm kind of, you know, stunned on this that these repair bills came in without witnesses. Were the witnesses unavailable, or what happened to cause the judge not to demand that these witnesses be produced and called to substantiate their estimates?
That is a point that we raised at trial court level, and there was no evidence at all of the unavailability of these witnesses. And if you look at the repair bids themselves, they were all local repair bids. None of these were out of town, out of state, and that was an issue that we did raise with the court. And bear in mind that when the objection was initially raised, Judge Young excluded the evidence because it was hearsay and it was expert testimony and they needed to be in court. As we moved through this trial, we got to a point where the court then on its own said, I'm going to reconsider that ruling, and actually took a break and allowed counsel time to literally go out and make copies of the bids so that they would be admitted. And we, of course, objected again, and the court then said, in his view, that this fell within Nevada's general exception to the hearsay rule under NRS 51.075. We, of course, argued that.
And well, that's if it's inherently reliable. I mean, I thought that's generally for something that's really not in controversy to invoke that general exception under...
I would agree. Because the nature of these repair bills are not unusual, and these are classic damages by experts that weren't available for cross-examination, and quite frankly, one of the other issues we had was undisclosed expert testimony.
None of this was handled in pretrial discovery?
Yes. We filed motions to exclude all of this evidence because there had been no disclosures of these particular experts.
But nothing was done with them in pretrial discovery? No depositions of the people with the bids?
No.
But you had the bids during the discovery period, and you could have easily taken those depositions, correct?
If we had been informed that, in fact, this would be testimony to be elicited as expert testimony, yes, we would have.
Assuming that we agree with you that it constitutes expert testimony, if we don't agree, why wouldn't you take those depositions? You know the bids were there and you knew what they were going to be used for. Why didn't you depose the declarants?
It's a decision you always make in litigation about what depositions you take and what's the value of taking the deposition. Had we been informed that this would be testimony that would be offered as expert testimony, we would have taken the depositions, but they were not. In fact, in the responses to our written discovery on this issue, the response was, you have the bids, you have the documents, that's it. That's not going to be expert testimony. There were no opinions, there were no backup, no responses, and in the pretrial disclosures, they weren't listed as experts. Had they been listed as experts, yes, we would have had the opportunity to depose those that we thought were significant and needed to be deposed. Not every one of them would have necessarily been deposed, but certainly the most substantial ones would have been deposed. And that would have been our practice, and that's what we would have done, but that's not what happened.
And even if they were disclosed, I mean, even if you had to post some of them, that still wouldn't cure the hearsay problem because they were all available and local, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is, therein lies the major problem. And the exception that the court cited to under 51.075, just not applicable, because the nature of these bids are just usual and ordinary bids. There were no special circumstances. These bids were prepared for trial. These bids were prepared to be introduced as evidence. And we made the initial objection. The court kept it out. There's nothing in these bids that has any indicia of special circumstances that offer assurances of reliability. These are just expert bids that were going to be offered. And then, of course, under the exception,
if... Mr. Henderson?
I'm sorry.
Sir, didn't Hole request that the bids be done? Wasn't it Hole that actually requested bids?
It's a long story. Let me make it short. What happened is, at the end of the leasehold period, there were discussions between Hole and Hellwinkle about repairs that needed to be done to the property. And at one point in time, Hole asked that bids be prepared so he could compare those bids with the bids that he had. That's all prior to trial. Then we fast forward and move into trial. And that's not, those aren't our bids. They're Hellwinkle's bids. We don't know what the charging orders were to the experts. We don't know what they were asked to do. We don't know what the assumptions were that they made. We don't know what the basis is for their bids. And if you look at the bids, they're all over the place. Some of the bids come in $15,000 or $20,000 different than other bids that come in. But when it came time to have the bids introduced, they put everything in. And we're just trying to sort through that. And the court, frankly, was struggling with which bids to use, and he just picked and chose which bids he thought were most appropriate. But no, we didn't ask for those bids, and we certainly didn't ask those bids to be evidence in this proceeding. That was only while they were trying to reduce the areas of conflict in the termination of the lease period.
Mr. Gunnarsson, just to follow up on that question, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is during throughout the lease hold period, Hellwinkle made requests for you to make repairs and submitted bids at that time. It just wasn't at the end of the leasehold, correct? They had requested repairs periodically throughout the lease.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the evidence is that Mr. Hellwinkle was on the premises quite a bit and demanding repairs to be done.
And that's when bids were also presented, correct?
And there were some bids presented, but the vast majority of those bids were at the back end of the lease period,
okay,
not during the lease period.
Thank you.
Mr. Gunnarsson, can I ask you about another issue in the case? And I want to hear from Mr. Bowen about it, too. That's the calculation of damages under the category of waste. And my understanding is there was some lost rent for loss of use of the property that was awarded under a waste claim. So if I'm wrong, please tell me. And
yes,
tell me what you think, and I can hear from the other side.
Yes, that is correct. The court also erred, in our view, in the calculation of waste damages to real property. It's our view that the law is that for damages to real property for waste, the calculation should be the cost of remediation or the diminution in fair market value of the property. The property was fully and completely remediated by Hole at Hole's sole cost and expense, and it was a substantial expense.
But it was out of use during the period of time that remediation was being undertaken, correct?
There's no evidence in the record that the remediation efforts caused an inability to lease the property. No evidence whatsoever. There may have been an assumption that it was not. But the areas of remediation in this case, Your Honor, were very small, two very small areas of a very large parcel, one behind a waste dumpster and one where a barrel had tipped over.
But they were environmental contamination that might, I mean, I thought one of the experts, I forget his name, testified that the contamination was going to depress the ability to release that property until it was cleared out.
Mr. Uhart was the
Uhart
expert, but he did not testify that the property could not be leased. In fact, our expert came in and said it was a small area, could be closed off, and we're talking about a very substantial piece of real property. It didn't affect the majority of the property itself.
Would you concede that if it had diminished the ability to lease it, that lost rental would be an appropriate measure of damages?
It may be recoverable under some theory, maybe breach of contract.
And your lease required you to return that property in the same condition, right?
It did, and that lease provision provision concerning remediation is interesting because Hole is given a reasonable time to promptly remediate. There's no time period there.
Okay.
So they did that, and there's no evidence in the record at all that the time that they took was unreasonable, and there was no testimony in the record as to the actual lost rents. Indeed, the lost rents was just a calculation of a number that bore no relationship to the fair market value of the property.
Your client had been paying, right?
Well, but the problem is...
That was calculated years back. I understand your
argument. You're talking about completely different economic conditions.
Yeah.
Our expert came in and said, if you could lease it, it'd be maybe $5,000 a month. So you can't just walk in and multiply the lease rate of an expired lease and say that's the current fair market value. That's not appropriate.
Mr. Gunderson, you have 3:38 left at this point.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices, good morning. My name is Dan Bowen, and I am here on behalf of the respondent. And I will address you in the same order that Mr. Gunderson did. 51075 was the first matter. NRS 51075, which provides that a statement is not excluded by the hearsay rule if its nature and the special circumstances under which it was made offer assurances of accuracy. Now, Mr. Conroy, Hole's manager at the Minden, requested that Mr. Hellwinkle obtain bids to fix all of the items that Mr. Hellwinkle had presented to Mr. Conroy in 2013. And that's at JA Volume 10, page 1876, line 6, through page 1878, line 17. Mr. Hellroy, at Mr. Conroy's request, obtained two bids on each major item of repair. This was a year before the litigation was commenced, and Mr. Hellwinkle did not tell the bidders that it was for litigation, but to effect repairs.
But how do we know that? If you don't call them as a witness and they can't be tested, how do you determine whether or not there was a special relationship between Hellwinkle and these contractors? Well, doesn't that inject an element into your argument that create some uncertainty?
You couldn't determine what you just asked, Your Honor, but Mr. Hellwinkle testified as to what he told the contractors, who they were. He contacted them out of the phone book. They're the local contractors. Somebody raised the issue of, weren't these people available? Well, these bids were done in 2013. This case went to trial in 2016. There were 16 bids. Probably eight of them had two bids. So we're talking 25 or 30 people to come in and tell the judge about a bid to clean the bathrooms, to replace a wash basin, to bolt three light poles back down to the concrete that had been knocked down by cars, for which Mr. Hellwinkle collected the insurance money and didn't replace the light poles. The court decided it had already heard expert testimony on each of the bids through Mr. Uhart, who examined the property, examined the bids, said they were necessary, and said they were reasonable. Now, I go on, the bids were disclosed pursuant to 16.1, and they were in our damage disclosure filings. each bid item by item in the damage disclosure. So for them to say, we didn't know this is what you were basing your damages on, well.
Mr. Bone, can I ask you about the admissibility of under 51.075? You've had a lot, you've been around a long time, done a lot of trials on that. I have never, as an attorney or a judge, ever seen a case where an expert witness, a report like this, that's critical to the outcome of the case has been admitted as under the general exception of 51.075. I'm stunned by this, that the judge would do this. Now, convince me why he didn't abuse his discretion.
Your Honor, in Townsend, I would cite you to Townsend v. State,
okay,
which is 103 Nevada 113, 117, 1987, which says whether specialized knowledge will assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence. That's the test, and that's left to the judge to determine whether he needs expert testimony. As I said, the judge did not need expert testimony, did not deem this expert testimony to reinstall a wash basin, to clean the bathrooms. He could understand the bids and he could understand the evidence. The bids were not prepared for litigation. The bidders had no reason to fabricate. They thought it was the repair and they were trying to get a job. Common sense dictates that you would present the lowest bid you could live with in that
matter. But part of the problem is these bids, you get two bids and they're pretty disparate in many instances, and you don't know the entire scope of work that they're bidding on. And whether they're, you know, they had a Ford and they're building a Cadillac, you don't have any of that opportunity for cross-examination or any of that.
This was all disclosed. Mr. Gunderson deposed Mr. Hellwinkle in May of 2015, 1 year before the trial. He could have asked him about any of the bids. May have. I haven't read that entire deposition, but he deposed him a year before trial. He could have explored all he wanted with the bids. He could have deposed the bidders. NRS 51.
What's your site for your expert? Another way could have been to have an overarching expert who would sort of be the Trojan horse for all this hearsay. But I don't see in the record where your expert says, item by item, this needed to be done, and this is, in my estimation, a fair and reasonable price for this scope of work.
It's in Newhart's deposition, and if I can take a minute to look it up, but I really don't want to. It's in Newhart's testimony. They went through bid by bid by bid. Was that bid necessary? Was it Hull's responsibility? Was the bid reasonable? He testified to all that.
And was that disclosed as expert that he would testify to that before trial? Was it disclosed that he would do that?
Yes, he was an expert. It was disclosed that he was going to testify about the bids, the reasonableness, the necessity, and everything.
Mr. Bowen, if I might, at the record, page 2638, Mr. Ewart is specifically asked, now you also mentioned that you reviewed several bids, cost or repair for this property throughout your term as an expert. Yes, I did. And then he goes on to discuss why he felt those bids were reasonable and necessary. Mr. Gunderson had objected to that opinion, but the court overruled that objection. So, to Justice Pickering's question, did the opinion offered by Ewart overcome the hearsay issue that exists in this case?
Well, I think it does. As you know, experts can rely on hearsay. It doesn't have to be admissible evidence. All of the experts had their bids in their report, not just Mr. Ewart, but the other side's expert and our other expert, Mr. McGinnis, also had the bids in their report. So they relied upon the bids. They testified to the bids. And I want to get back to, if I can, 51.075. Because the appellants argue that both necessity and circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness are required in order to admit that. But the statute says nothing about necessity, nor do our cases say anything about necessity. The only case that even mentions necessity is Johnston versus State, 92 Nevada 241. 1976, wherein the court stated that our statute endorsed Judge Learned Hand's observation in 1913 that the requisites of an exception to the hearsay rule were necessity and circumstantial guarantee of trustworthiness. Actually, Judge Learned Hand picked that statement up from Wigmore on Evidence, Section 1421, 1422, and 1690, a relatively new publication when that case was decided, first edition, 1913, because he could not find a case to support what he wanted to do. The case cited by the Johnson Court, Dallas County v. Commercial Union Assurance Company, 206 Fed 380, Fed Second 388, 395 through 96, Fifth Circuit, 1961, explains this and also references Wigmore on Evidence, where it is explained that the word necessity, as here used, does not require a showing of total inaccessibility of firsthand evidence as a condition preceding to acceptance of a particular piece of hearsay. But necessity exists here where otherwise great practical inconvenience would be experienced in admitting the desired proof. And that's Wigmore on Evidence, third edition, volume 5, section 1421, and volume 6, section 1702. Indeed, and to answer Justice Pickering's question, it cannot be inaccessibility because the statute provides that it applies even though the witness is available.
So I'm trying to clarify something with you, Mr. Bowen. Are you saying that the testimony that supported the damages for repairs was admissible by virtue of the testimony of Mr. Uhart, who relied on them as experts do, rely on hearsay? Or are you saying that the support for the damage testimony comes in by virtue of the statute that has been raised by appellants? Because the testimony, as I read it, throughout pages 2638 through about 54 or so, there are several questions directed at Uhart about bids listed as exhibits 180, 181, 182, 183, dealing with epoxy floors, dealing with a whole series of issues here. And in those, in that questioning, he's asked, "Do these seem reasonable? Are they comparative? And is this the sort of work that needed to be done?" And he says yes. And then, "And do these bids, based on your expertise and experience, do these bids appear reasonable and necessary for replacing, in this instance, the floor areas that we talked about, for repairing the floor area or replacing? Yes, they do." So my question is this evidence admissible by virtue of that expert's testimony, independent or separate from the hearsay objection?
I believe it is. And it is hearsay, and I believe it's admissible through the experts, but I also believe it's admissible under 51075, because necessity is not required.
Just to follow up, I'm sorry to do this, but was this expert designated as the person through whom these bids would be admitted? Say we disagree with you on 075.
Specifically referenced the bids.
Okay.
Close as an expert to testify about the repairs. All,
what about the amount of the price of the repairs? Was he disclosed as somebody who was going to put a number on the repairs?
Well, he had his expert report, and he said they were all reasonable in the expert report, and that was disclosed before the trial. It's all in his report, as well as his testimony. But these bids are admissible under 51075, because there was no reason to lie or prevaricate. There was no, it would have been a great inconvenience to call 25 or 30 bidders who bid 3 years ago to find them, bring them into court when it wasn't necessary.
But the problem is, if you just have bids, you don't necessarily know the scope of work and whether or not they are bidding on something your opposing counsel's client was obligated to do. They're, sure, property deteriorates over time, but you have to demonstrate that that work was something that this guy was obligated to do. in the fashion that it was being bid.
The experts testified that they were obligated to do it, that Mr. Hull was obligated to do it. He reviewed the property, reviewed the bids, and said the bids were necessary, the work was necessary. It was never even in dispute. I don't think there's any conflicting evidence that this property was not properly maintained.
I grant you that, but on the bid by bid, I think to get in under the residual, it has to be so clear that no cross-examination is really going to help matters much.
That doesn't explain the cases, though, Your Honor, such as Emmons v. State allowing a medical examiner to testify regarding a urologist's concurring opinion, State Department of Motor Vehicles versus KIF, 101 Nevada 729-1985, allowed in hearsay from one officer to another about how KIF was driving the car on a DUI license. Revocation, no one got to depose that officer. What did he look like? Was he drunk when he got out of the car? And the one that's the best one, and this was an en banc decision, maybe not on, specifically on that matter, but is in re termination of parental rights to NJ, 116 Nevada 790, which allowed in a letter written in Arabic and translated, even though the letter writer was not available at trial. But under this 51075, it doesn't matter whether it's available or not, because it says it doesn't matter whether the witness is available. So, there was no reason to fabricate this. The judge heard argument and looked at the evidence on this for an hour. It went on and on several times before he made his decision. He looked at the law. He looked at these cases that allowed all of these hearsay statements in under 51075. Now, you might say, well, Mr. Bowen, what if it was just one bid rather than all these bids? Well, that might be different because it was just one bid. There wouldn't be great practical inconvenience to the court. It wouldn't take 3 days of court time to have someone come in and say, yeah, that's my bid. I made it 3 years ago. That was my bid. That's all they were going to say because this is not expert testimony. The court deemed it not expert testimony. It's lay stuff. You know, the wash basin, they had the receipts for that, what it cost. They stole the wash basin. It was a great big thing where lots of men could wash their hands at one time. I guess I'm out of time, but I would like to say that all of the cases, other than in Nevada, which is a dearth of law, all of the cases in the United States basically say, whether it's trespass, whether it's waste, or whether it's nuisance, they all come out the same. It's depreciation of the property, if that's the case, if it's temporary, it's lost rents and to restore the property. And one thing I want to point out in their brief, they keep saying that the cases say remediate the property, but the cases don't say remediate. The cases say restore the property back to its condition prior to the injury. All of the cases say that. None of the cases use the word remediate, especially in the sense that Mr. Hull is using it. Well, we remediated it good enough for in-depth healthcare, so your
time is up.
Chief,
thank you.
May I pose one additional
question? Mr. Bowen, don't wander off. We have one more question, it seems.
Mr. Bowen, I had a question. Could you clarify for me the two issues? First, the period of time between Hull's departure from the property and when the remediation, as was characterized by Mr. Gunderson, took place, and whether you folks, he or you, litigated whether that time was reasonable or unreasonable.
For the time to remediate the property, we did not litigate that.
And do you recall the period of time from the departure to the remediation?
I have it, Your Honor. Just 1 second. It was November 5th, I believe, that the remediation of 2013, the remediation was found November 5th. It didn't start till sometime after that, maybe in the summer, closer to the summer. The lease expired December 13th of 2013. NDEP didn't issue a no further action letter until sometime in January of 2015. And that's why the Hellwinkles were out 13 months and 6 days of rent. As to that rent, their own expert testified $1 a square foot was fair rent in that area. Michael Hull was paying 76 cents a square foot. The lease had been in effect for 10 years. There were no CPIs, no increases. It was more than substantial evidence for this judge to conclude that the rent that had been being paid was fair rent. And to answer your question, if I might, Justice Pickering, Mr. Kimmel, our expert, testified that it, and all the experts testified, it is virtually impossible to lease or sell a piece of property while the remediation project is ongoing. And this was not small. You've seen the pictures. Thank you.
Mr. Gunderson?
I want to address, if I might, first the issues raised by Justice Hardesty. Mr. Uhart was listed as an expert. He was disclosed as an expert. He did not, he prepared an expert opinion. His opinion that was a written opinion of his testimony as an expert did not include the reasonableness of the bids. When he was asked that question at trial, Justice Hardesty, I objected because it was beyond the scope of his expert opinion. I took Mr. Uhart back to his testimony and what his opinion was, and you will find that on page 2685. And this is what I asked. I want your opinion. You stated, I have read through all of the bids that were submitted to correct and fix the various problems that were identified and issues pertaining to the property and the premises. There are several bids submitted for each item. This is very good business practice, and I always obtain several bids. Then decide which one will be timelier, factor in the cost, and who would have been the best warranty or guarantee. And I said, that's your opinion. That was his opinion. That was the disclosed opinion in his expert report in the expert witness disclosures. They come to trial then and try to bootstrap around because they're having trouble getting those bids in and try to then add in Mr. Uhart's opinion on the reasonableness of each of the bids. And they did not go through each of the bids. It was just a general statement as to the bids themselves.
So I'm glad you addressed that point, Mr. Gunderson, because it raised an issue. And I'm not sure the jurisprudence supports this concept, but I'd like your view on it. In circumstances such as this, does the fact that the bids were produced way early in the process, even before, I guess, litigation took place, the fact that your clients had an opportunity to look at those, the fact that Uhart then testified as indicated there, satisfy the first factor under the statute that it appears there's a reason to believe that there's no reason, I should say, to question the accuracy of the bids.
The accuracy of the bids all relate to what the assumptions were and the scope of the work. We didn't know that, couldn't test it, and when you have so many different bids with different prices, clearly that's important. So having an opinion, having a bid, having a repair estimate, if you don't know what the underlying assumptions are, is very difficult to use. But when you get to the bottom line, Mr. Uhart was not disclosed as an expert on the reasonableness of those damages that they're claiming that came in through the inadmissible hearsay bids. That was not his opinion, and that's why the objection was raised. Lastly, if we come back to the remediation process,
go ahead and make your statement, please.
No question, it was fully done, fully completed. Nevada Division of Environmental Protection issued a no-action letter, no harm, no foul. It's a little over 11 months, and we think the damage calculation based on raw loss rent is unsupported in the record. Thank you very much.
Court thanks both counsel for their arguments today, shedding light on matters of interest to this court. This matter will stand submitted.